Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. The purpose of this podcast is to focus on trying to find solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly talking about the problems themselves. Some problems seem intractable. One of them is Iran. And joining us this week is the great Christiane Onimpour of CNN, legendary global journalist, someone I'm proud to call a friend, and this has been covering Iran closely since she was a child. She, in fact, grew up in Iran, and it was the Iranian Revolution that first spurred her interest in geopolitics. Christiane, thank you for joining us.
John, you're absolutely welcome. I have to say, you know, I'm feeling quite emotional, quite vested. This is my country. You know, it is, as you say, the 1979 revolution that spurred me to come to the United States, go to university for the strict purpose of becoming a journalist and wanting to cover these kinds of global events. And I've been covering Iran since then, you know, very regularly for the last 47 years odd, not quite, because I wasn't a journalist exactly 47 years ago, but about 40 years for sure. And, I'm watching every time there's this kind of uprising, which was snuffed out 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. This latest one. I've covered many of them on the ground there. The last big one I covered was in 2009, the so-called Green Revolution. And up until now, we have seen that the people's legitimate struggle for freedom, for democracy, for the ability to earn a living wage and to not be condemned to poverty, their struggles are regularly snuffed out by a very powerful regime that doesn't want to see any other revolution and wants, up until now, its raison d'etre has been survival of the regime.
Sure, and as all regimes do, and it does seem to default to sort of Tiananmen Square-esque response, over 2,500 people murdered. That's the low ball count. I guess the question, given your historic perspective and the number of times you've covered these uprisings, is this time different? Do you think this will be different?
I don't know about will be, because we're waiting to see what actually does happen, but I think it was different. I think that figure you just posited is lowball, even by the accounts of the Islamic Republic. They went on, I think it was the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, this weekend on state television, who used a 3,000 figure. But of course, they say that a lot of them were, quote, innocent martyrs. And by that, I think they mean regime loyalists. I think they mean, you know, the security services. There were those who were killed. And they probably mean the peaceful protesters. And as you know, by all accounts, it was incredibly peaceful until it turned very bloody on the weekend, the Iranian weekend of January 8th to 11th. That's when it was crushed. And that's when there was a lot of gunfire. That's when we hear stories from certainly people I know there, voice notes that have come out to other people who I know who share them with me, of a sudden descent by the armed security forces, both the Revolutionary Guard, but most importantly, in terms of the people, it's their shock troops, right? It's their forces called the Basij, the sort of so-called volunteer foot soldiers of the regime, who come on motorcycles, who wield guns. In this case, I was told about automatic weapons fire. People use the word Kalashnikov, and maybe it was, it wasn't, but they said automatic weapons fire. They use chains that they, you know, swing around and then beat people. They try to get into people's homes. There's been very repressive surveillance, some people say using Chinese-supplied surveillance technology, whereby the regime went on state television regularly. They didn't say it was Chinese-supplied technology, but they said that we know where you are, we can see where you're parking your cars, we know that that's a point of protest. And they also, I was told, sent text messages to parents and family members saying, you know, do not let your child go out of the house to protest. Here's a picture of your child's car. Here's the license plate, it is your child's vehicle, and we know where they've been. So this is, you know, these are terror tactics, they're fear tactics, and combined with the bloody repression, you know, it snuffed it out for now.
Well, for now. And I think one of the things that structurally may make this different, there was a fascinating piece in The Atlantic about the five conditions that tend to lead to regimes being toppled. One of them was this was spurred by high inflation. The protests began in the market square, And that the regime has become delegitimized because of the endemic corruption. Nobody believes. And so all those are forcing factors. But of course, the ultimate check on that is force. And that raises the question of a possible U.S. response. U.S. carriers have been sent to the region. The head of Lazard Frere said in an interview at Davos, just a few hours ago that he had a feeling, perhaps some, under the table information, that there could be an escalation. He was not specific about what that would look like. But given that the carriers are in place, there's always the chance of a kinetic strike. Do you think that is wise, or do you think that would cause a backlash against the uprising, were that to occur?
Peter Orszag actually said something big is going to happen, according to his information, as you state. Now, what is that something big? I do not know. I didn't answer your question properly about whether this was different from before. I think, yes, it was different from before, because it encompassed so many different types of people, walks of life, classes, religious, non-religious, and cities, geographic location. It was all over. And I think it was met by even more violence than previously, just by the numbers and by the testimonials from hospitals and elsewhere. Now, here's the thing. Let's step back a bit. In June, as we all know, the fourth or fifth or whatever rail was crossed, this shadow war between Iran and Israel that's been going on for a long, long time throughout the Bibi Netanyahu regime. He's been in and out of power for decades, and his obsession has been the overthrow and the containment of the Iranian Ayatollah Islamic Republic. He believes, as we've seen, that only a massive Israeli military superiority will keep Israel safe in that region. So we saw Gaza was demolished and Hamas has been defanged pretty much. They've done the same in Lebanon, trying to defang Hezbollah. They did a bit of Yemen, they did a bit of here and there. Then they turn to Iran. And as I say, they have constantly been held responsible by Iranians and by others who know in the intelligence service. They've even made their own films and series about it, To Witness Tehran, which is about Israeli agents infiltrating either themselves or with their paid instigators on the ground to, for a while, kill off Iranian nuclear scientists, then disrupt and destroy parts of the Iranian nuclear plants, like in Isfahan and elsewhere. Then, bold roadside bombs that killed, an Iranian, one of the most famous Iranian nuclear scientists. So that was all a little bit of yesterday, but it showed their intent and their capability. Then they decided, after the missile war and everything, over their assassinations of Iranians and others, including inside Iran, there was a missile war that went on in the spring. That was stopped, and Israel was protected by a whole load of allies, including the United States. Then in June, the Israelis decided, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to go. And they did. And it appears that they took out huge amounts of, maybe decisive amounts of Iranian anti-aircraft, of all the surveillance. They've been around and hit many, 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 if not all, the military bases, including around the Persian Gulf and elsewhere. Obviously, also the nuclear plants. The U.S. came in and helped with the nuclear plants. Now, to say that the Israelis for sure were also talking about regime change. They say they weren't. They say that that wasn't their objective. But a lot of what we heard and saw and read from there said that that would be a very welcome byproduct, let's say, of their military intervention. It didn't happen. The people then were absolutely shocked. The Iranian people, they couldn't believe they were being attacked, bombed, and they rallied round, not necessarily the Ayatollahs, but around their country. They showed a nationalist streak, yes, which they also did back in the Iran-Iraq war, where they rallied round rather than submit to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran back in 1980. Sure. So just laying the table. Then Trump ups the ante by saying, in this latest outburst of protests, which did start over the economy, poverty, lack of water, all of that, he said, we will, help is on the way. And help didn't come. Even after Trump called the protesters out, after Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince, who puts himself out there as the main opposition leader, called the people out. They did come out on that fateful weekend, January 8th to the 11th, and the regime responded in kind. And there was no help. Now, some have said, John, I'm sorry to go on, that it's because the president could not get the right military options from his Pentagon because a lot of the assets were tied up around Venezuela. So now we understand that these assets, whether they're aircraft carriers and all the rest of it that goes with an aircraft carrier, are headed to the region, which is presumably the Persian Gulf region. What's that for? We do not know. Is it to bomb again? Is it to try a Venezuela-style, you know, decapitation? What would that lead to? What would that mean? Is it to do a Venezuela-style decapitation and deal with whoever may be the strong people in Iran afterwards, left standing? Or what? We don't know. Or is it to seize oil tankers and completely collapse their economy? You know, Benjamin Netanyahu was in Mar-a-Lago on December 29th and probably had all these conversations, of course he did, with President Trump. And we're just going to wait and see what happens. So that's a long way around saying, I don't know.
Stay tuned. And certainly Pete Orszag's phrase, something big, could include any number of things. I think we should say that the strikes against the nuclear program did also, I think it's fair to say, pierce any veil of invincibility around the regime, which is always key to a successful uprising. But of course, there are alternatives.
Not around the regime, John. The regime survived.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, pierce the people's sense that it was an invincible power.
I don't know. The regime survived. I think this is the very important psychological point that you've put your finger on, because for an uprising, I'm not sure that it can happen from the air, regime change. You have to be able to convince the people, including the military, that they are going to be losers if they stick with this. Like in 1979, yep. It was when the military basically refused to keep firing on the people and essentially turned towards the people. And I guess Khomeini, the Ayatollah, that's when the revolution was possible.
Now that the holidays are over, you might be feeling like you got a big spending hangover. The drinks, the food, the gifts, it all adds up, doesn't it? Well, luckily, Mint Mobile is here to help you cut back on overspending on wireless this January with, get this, 50% off unlimited premium wireless. Mint Mobile's end-of-the-year sale is still going on. They haven't gotten the news. It's January, but only until the end of this month. So you've only got a couple weeks left to cut out big wireless's bloated plans and unnecessary monthly charges with 50% off 3, 6, or 12 months of unlimited with Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered over the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. So this January, quit overspending on wireless with 50% off unlimited premium wireless. Plans start at $15 a month at mintmobile.com/fixit, all caps. That's mintmobile.com/fixit. This is a limited time offer. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month, $90 for 6 month, or $180 for 12 month plan required. That's $15 a month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Above 50 gigabyte speeds may slow when network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com. An alternative would be cyber. One of the ways that the crackdown occurred is that they did a complete blackout. So it's been difficult to get images and messages out as they had been. In your experience, because, you know, kinetic strikes are not, do not have a great record, possible exception being Yugoslavia, of spurring regime change. So do you think a cyber strike, if you were advising on policy, which you most certainly are not, do you think a cyber strike would actually be more effective and less likely to court the kind of nationalist backlash?
I don't know. It's just as simple as that. I don't know. We haven't seen that happen. We don't know what a massive cyber strike in order to change a regime would look like. The only things I've ever covered are military interventions. I mean, clearly Iraq stands out as the huge one. Yes. That failed so miserably. Yeah, it got rid of Saddam Hussein eventually, but they just made such a balls up of it afterwards. They went de-bathification. Yes. They essentially destroyed the country. Not only that, they turned all the people who they said would work for them. And by the way, this is important. They, Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney, told the Iraqi Republican Guard and the police there to lay down your arms. Don't resist us when we invade, and we will work with you to rebuild, you know, a post-Saddam Iraq. And guess what they did? And then the Americans, the occupation force run by, you know, Paul Bremer and such, completely turned on their word and, in fact, fired everybody who they had successfully got to not oppose them. So those people went out and formed the insurgency that became, you know, AQIM, Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, then led to ISIS, et cetera, et cetera. And we know what happened. So if the IRGC, the Republican Guard in Iran, is thinking, hang on a second, maybe they're reaching out to some of us and saying, work with us. Well, hang on. They said that in Iraq, but it didn't work there.
To your point, I mean, depathification was a disaster. So anyone who throws around that term needs to remember the context. It fundamentally undermined any attempt to stabilize and rebuild the nation. And that's the case of Iraq. I want to ask you, you mentioned Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah. Mm-hmm. He is sending messages, is being touted as an opposition leader, inspirational leader, says he wants to transition to real democracy. As someone who grew up in the Shah's Iran, what is your sense of his credibility as an opposition leader?
Well, we've certainly seen that his name has been shouted from the streets, and we know that because there's no other names, his is the only most known name. And especially, John, and this is important, amongst the younger Gen Z, because the older folks, you know, they might be protesting, but they're not calling for the Shah necessarily to come back. I'm talking about inside Iran. Mm-hmm. The diaspora all want the Shah son to come back. And that's his base. The question is not what his intentions are, but what the capability is. Because just diaspora won't work. You have to have, you know, an organization inside. You have to have a communication set up. You have to have basically unity, which they haven't been able to have, even in the diaspora. You know, after Women Life Freedom, Zan Zendegi Azadi, Women Life Freedom, they came together on the stage, if you remember, Reza Pahlavi and a whole bunch of others holding hands just about saying that we are going to put aside our differences and work for the betterment of our country. Within 2 weeks or 2 months, it was gone. The rivalries just ripped that apart. So I think that's a very legitimate question that people have to ask. If you want to somehow be a credible transition figure that doesn't fall into the traps that bedeviled even the, you know, the diaspora in Iraq, who believed that they could be transition figures and who essentially led the U.S. down the garden path, Ahmad Chalabi and all those names who you might remember, you've got to really be able to not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. And it takes organization. I think people are desperate in Iran, having said that. They want to see change. All the elections that I've covered, and yes, we might grumble that they're not real elections and this and that, but they're a lot more real and representative than anything in that region, in any Arab state or whatever. And what they've shown is, with a limited, highly vetted group of people who are allowed to run for president, always the most liberal, reform-minded, whatever you want to call them, moderate, least Ayatollah-like wins, except for one or two times. But in general, the people have spoken with whatever voice they can raise that they absolutely want change, that they want democratic change, they want a proper economy. So the question is, will it be a democracy if the Ayatollahs fall, or will it be a military dictatorship by the right. IRGC? I don't know.
And that is the key question. This show is sponsored by Superpower. Now, if you're walking into the doctor lately and you know something's not quite right, but you've been told that everything's fine, or you just need to drink some water and you're left without any real plan, you got to give Superpower a look. Superpower sends a licensed professional to your home, or you can visit a nearby lab. It's one simple blood draw with over 100 biomarkers, way more than what you'd normally get, which unlocks so much more about your own body. Their app includes detailed information on your heart, liver, thyroid, hormones, metabolism, vitamin and mineral levels, even environmental toxins. So from disease prevention to treating that annoying brain fog or simply optimizing your gym game, Superpower is the most comprehensive and advanced system out there. Superpower not only gives you an initial plan, but it tracks your results over your lifetime. Each test is built on the last, giving you a full picture of your progress year after year. So stop reacting to health problems after they show up and start proactively improving your health with real personalized data as part of your New Year reset. Superpower used to cost $499, that's $499, but right now it's just $199 for the full experience. Your blueprint activated with Superpower. Not only did Superpower reduce their price to just $199, but for a limited time, our listeners are getting an additional $20 off with code FIXIT, all caps. So head over to superpower.com and use the code FIXIT at checkout for $20 off your membership. After you sign up, they'll ask how you heard about them. And please make sure to tell them this podcast to support the show. How to Fix It on the Bull. I want to add one more historic comp because the ghost of Mossadegh hangs over all of this. You know, that was the CIA and British-backed attempt to, as you well know, I'm just for folks who might not, a bit of a deep cut. There's a great book, All the Shah's Men, folks should read.
Oh, it's so good.
Brilliant. But it really did show, I mean, we meddled. We overturned a democratically elected leader who was a nationalist figure. And that's part of the seeds of the distrust. And it was one of the reasons cited by Obama for not pushing the Green Revolution more directly. He didn't want to undermine, he felt, the opposition by having the U.S. back it explicitly. How much do you think that lessons, what do you think are the right lessons of the Green Revolution and Obama's decision not to intervene or not to support actively, which then, of course, led to no lasting change?
Okay, so I was there for the so-called Green Revolution, and it was because there was an election. The hated Ahmadinejad, the odious Ahmadinejad, not just at home but on the international stage, he made Iran even more of a pariah than it was. He is considered not to have won that election. It was a re-election in 2009, and the civilian opposition, who were immediately, you know, dispatched to house arrest and arrest and all the rest of it, they were considered to have won. So the people, you know, went into the streets for days and weeks, and again, it was violently and bloodily suppressed. Now, to this day, nobody really knows whether the Green Revolution was the name and what that name implies was a construct of the diaspora opposition, or was it something that really happened there? I saw an uprising, I saw protests, but I was only in Tehran, and I saw, you know, in the end it was crushed. But Obama didn't support, and people were angry. Mostly people in the diaspora, Iranians, were very, very angry. They say to me now, every time I walk around now, will Trump help? Will he help? Will he come to our help? And I say, well, I just don't know. He said he would. He hasn't yet. But they are desperate for some kind of help because they don't think they can do it on their own. The question is, what kind of help will be successful and will help the people? You know, we talked about Iraq because that's a salutary lesson as to how it can really go to hell. But Venezuela is slightly different. They decapitated the leadership, but guess what they're doing? They are working, John, with the Venezuelan government that they decapitated. Now, you know, maybe Delcy Rodriguez, it seems now, you know, she's given, there's some reports that she might have been in on it from the beginning, might have given the green light to the Trump administration, but it's still a country on its knees, and it's still essentially got the old order still in place. And President Trump has essentially not given any space to the Democratic opposition, despite meeting with, you know, Maria Corina Machado, who won the Nobel Prize. So it appears that democracy is not necessarily, or up until now, not their first objective. And that's a problem. When you go back to the Mossadegh coup in 1952 or three, I always get the date wrong. That was the beginning of American coups around the world. And it was the height of the Cold War, and they all had terrible blowback. It can be traced from overthrowing Mossadegh, who was, in their view, you know, in a constitutional way elected as prime minister, bringing back the Shah. It can be traced to leading to the 1979 backlash, which was the revolution. And then they went to Congo, right? They killed off Patrice Lumumba. And what happened in Congo? You had, you know, years and decades of Mobutu and murders and you know, repression. And then it was in Central America and
Chile, yeah.
And South America, all the backing of all these, you know, military regimes during the Cold War. I mean, horrendous bedfellows, all talked about in geopolitics, which were really bad for the people of those countries. So it's a big question. When does the US intervene in a political way? You know, in Bosnia, as we talked about, it was humanitarian and it was successful. But in a political way, to make it work for the people and not just for the oil and not just for, you know, control or hemispheric dominance or whatever. And by the way, can the United States separate its own foreign policy goals from Benjamin Netanyahu's foreign policy goals? That's a very key question.
A key question.
In this regard, in regard to the Middle East and specifically to Iran.
Look, this is still unfolding. The one thing I think we do know is under the Trump administration, there is no freedom agenda. Let's just be very clear about that, for better or for worse. Christian Anandpour, thank you so much for joining us, giving us your wisdom here on How to Fix It. I appreciate it. I appreciate you.
My pleasure. And I just wanted to say, you know, farewell by saying, and we've got to help Ukraine. We have got to help Ukraine. We cannot take our eye off that ball. Ukraine is the victim. Ukraine stands for all Europeans and all freedom-loving people who do not want to be under the tyrannical boot of an illegal aggressor. So right now, Trump is sending his envoys to Moscow. Let's hope something good and fair and just comes out of that.
Here's hoping. You're damn right. That is where our attention should be. But Trump is spreading it around the world. Christian,
at least he's
thank
pulled
you.
Back from Greenland.
Well,
in a
we'll
way,
we'll see.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. What unfortunately is true is that the United States has lost its moral authority at the moment, and we will have to build that back over time. Christian Anandpour, thank you for joining us on How to Fix It. Appreciate
thank
it.
You, John.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.